Kitty Hart Moxon, Reel 2.
So, could you tell us briefly the story of one of your escapes from the ghetto?
Well, we attempted 3 escapes from the ghetto. Of course, the one escape was rather dramatic because my father managed to procure a horse and cart, and we traveled for some days, mostly during the night. Of course, there was a curfew during the night, but nonetheless, it was too dangerous to travel during the day without our papers, because we'd taken off all our armbands and thrown away all our documents. We traveled to the Russian, at that time, Russian frontier on the River Bug. The Russians, the beginning of the war, occupied part of Poland as far as the River Bug, and we were not all that far away. But of course, that was winter, and most of the time we had to actually push the horse and cart because the roads were covered, were absolutely, there was deep snow, and the wheels stuck in the snow. Or perhaps it was a sleigh. It could have been a sleigh because it was in the winter. We waited at the frontier some days for the river to freeze, but we'd been told that we'd arrived 24 hours too late because the frontier was open until that time and people were actually crossing the river. But we'd arrived too late, and so we had to cross the river illegally. Now, we stayed about 3 weeks on the riverbank, and I learned to see when the patrols were patrolling both on the Russian side and on the German side. And eventually we had a guide, and again we hired a sleigh, and we were all in this sleigh trying to cross the river, and we were almost across when we were hit by a hail of bullets, which came from both sides, we believe. The driver, or the guide, he simply wasn't going to go any further. We crouched down in the sleigh, and he couldn't because he was maneuvering the horse, and he swung the sleigh around and went back onto the German side. Now, the Germans came in to find out what all this commotion was about, because they were also shooting, and we had just got back to the little house, where a cottage where we stayed, and a patrol came in, and my father quickly produced his medals, put on his medals, and said to the patrol, "I am a German officer stranded here waiting to go back to the fatherland with my family." And the patrol saluted, clicked the heels, and walked out. And of course, my father realized that this game was up, that sooner or later they will want to know who this family is stranded on the German side, on the Russian border. And so we quickly gathered our belongings and made back into the Lublin ghetto. This was one of our escapes.
Maybe you could just also tell us briefly the story of, I think you were working for a dentist.
Oh, yes, yes. While in the ghetto, of course, children had very little to do, and to keep them occupied, parents tried to find all kind of occupations. But there were no books to read because they had all been confiscated. We were not allowed to go to school. My father had a friend who was a dentist. Dentists were not allowed to practice. And most of his equipment was inside the bed or underneath the bed, and my father had arranged with this dentist that I should actually help him to be his assistant. So I learned to mix all the fillings and whatever crowns, whatever he was doing, and whenever there was a patrol, we used to take all the equipment and quickly put it either inside the bed or underneath the bed, and you didn't know there was a dental practice. And I worked quite a few months with this dentist, just learning how to mix, mostly how to mix all the different ingredients for fillings. Whilst I was working for this dentist, my father decided it would be a very good idea if the dentist placed some diamonds into my teeth. So I had holes drilled into about 4 of my back teeth and filled with diamonds, because my father thought one day I might just need these. And how right he was, because this is exactly what happened. One day, these diamonds actually helped to save my life.
So, as I say, we take a bit of a leap now.
Yeah. Perhaps to make it flow, I should say my father did manage to obtain some false documents, Aryan documents. Must I say that? Because it doesn't follow.
Yes, okay, then they were the false documents.
I'm just thinking how you can connect it.
Yes, that's a good idea.
It is. And then how that resulted in being deported.
Eventually, after the third escape, my father did manage to obtain false documents from the very priest that my mother taught English, who always said, if you're in dire danger, a mortal danger, you must come to me. My mother and I were parted at that point from my father, who obviously couldn't continue to come with us, since he had totally different papers and was no longer related in name to my mother and myself. So my mother and I were taken to Germany, where we worked as forced laborers, and we were quite happily, we could have survived the war there quite happily, had it not been for some of the Polish girls who realized that we were Jewish, and we were denounced. We were taken to prison, we were sentenced to death in the first instance, put in front of a wall and almost executed. It didn't actually happen because our sentence was commuted to life slave labor in Auschwitz. And after having spent some time in three prisons, my mother and I found ourselves in a prison train on the way to Auschwitz. We traveled in a most unusual train, which was especially designed to carry prisoners. It was divided into small cages. Some held two prisoners, some held four prisoners, which were locked, and you could only stand. And this is how my mother actually was allowed into the camp, because she came with a transport of prisoners from a prison and not with a transport from a ghetto, because by that time she was already in her late 40s and she would have never been allowed into the camp.
Can you describe the train in a little bit more detail, and who else was on the train with you, and then describe
This train that we were transported on to Auschwitz was a brand new train. You could still smell the new paint, and it had been subdivided. The compartments were in fact converted into small cages, and all the windows had been whitewashed, so you couldn't look outside. There was just a bulb to light the compartments up. And I was in a cage. I think there were two Russian women, my mother and myself. We were in a cage which was actually only suitable for two people, but there were four of us, and we had to take it in turns to sit down. And my mother became extremely tired, because the two Russian women were very quarrelsome, and they just wouldn't allow her to sit down. We traveled probably about a day and a night, but it was very difficult to say whether it was day or night, because there was no view from inside to the outside, because the windows were whitewashed. There was just an electric bulb, so it could have been a day and a night before we actually arrived in Auschwitz in the early hours of the morning of the 6th of April of 1943.
Did you know where you were going? Were you told where you were going before you got on the train?
In the cell, I was in Dresden with a group of people, and the cell began to fill up. And people who were in that cell knew that they were going to Auschwitz. And, of course, this is how we got to know, because everyone in that cell was, it was known as a transit cell, and all the walls were scribbled with messages, see you in Auschwitz, goodbye, tomorrow we go to Auschwitz, tomorrow we go to hell. Well, my mother remembered Auschwitz as a fishing village some 30 kilometers north of our hometown. But she couldn't understand what we were going to do in Auschwitz. We had absolutely no idea that Auschwitz, that there was a camp in Auschwitz, or there was anything other than a fishing village. Yes, we did know we were going to Auschwitz. In fact, one of the German women prison warders who led us out, said, "Tomorrow you're going to Auschwitz." But of course it had absolutely no meaning whatsoever at that stage. As a matter of fact, we were in the Lublin ghetto surrounded by some 6 extermination sites, camps, Bauschwitz, Treblinka, Sobibor, and we had no idea that we were surrounded by these extermination camps. The secrecy was such that, and of course no one ever came out, and no one ever returned back to the ghetto, so no one knew of the extermination centers, and yet we were right in the center of it.
Can you describe the arrival of the train in Auschwitz? What happened to you?
Well, when we arrived in Auschwitz at very early hours of at dawn, we were actually disembarked what was known as Auschwitz I, not Birkenau. And a lot of male prisoners, because it was a male and female, there were men and women on the train, and the men were taken to Auschwitz I, and some of the women had been taken to Auschwitz I. Well, we didn't actually know about Auschwitz I or Auschwitz II. The rest of the train was marched past the gate, which we now know says Arbeit macht frei, and we walked some 2 or 3 kilometers, because at that stage the railway lines did not reach as far as Birkenau, and we approached an area surrounded by fences that was lit up. And the first thing that actually struck us was a kind of glow in a distant red glow, and a peculiar smell. And my mother turned to me, and I shall never forget this, because she said, "I can't understand the smell. Why would they be roasting meat at this time of the morning?" Because this is precisely what it seemed like, a smell of roasting meat. That was my first sight of Auschwitz, the red glow in the distance. I mean, we didn't know what it was.
Where were you taken, and what happened to you then?
We were taken into what was known as the extermination center, or Birkenau, and the whole of the transport, all the women taken off the train were simply brought into the camp. We were not, we hadn't gone through a process known as process of selection, which of course happened to most of the other people that arrived in Auschwitz. We were taken into a large hall, which was termed a sauna, where you were completely stripped. Everything was taken off you, from you. You were totally naked. You were shaved. Your head was shaved. Your pubic hair was shaved. You were shaved under your arms. And you were smeared with sort of a green fluid, and then you were taken to a next hall where you were given, well, at least we were given, uniforms belonging to Russian prisoners of war, because apparently 25,000 prisoners, Russian prisoners of war, had been killed prior to our arrival, and we were given their used uniforms. So everyone was issued with a sort of a khaki jacket and khaki trousers and a pair of clogs. We were then taken to another hall where we were tattooed on our left forearms. And my mother was tattooed first. Her number was 39933, and I was tattooed immediately afterwards 39934. After that, we were taken to a barrack, or what was known as a block, in what was known as a quarantine. But of course it wasn't such a thing as a quarantine. It was simply an initiation period into camp life.
Did you and your mother know any other people in the camp, or were you just a unit of 2 at that point?
Well, we were a unit of 13, actually, because it transpired that there were 13 of us on false papers, and we were all discovered and denounced. And so we, at that point, we were 13 Jewish women among thousands of 1,000, shall I say, 1,000 other women in this particular block. We were taken into a block, and of course, having arrived too late to receive any food whatsoever, we didn't receive a single bread ration until 24 hours after having left prison, or anything to drink.
After the shock of his arrival, being stripped and shaved and tattooed, what did you think was going to happen to you? Did you think you were there for work, or what?
I had no idea what I was actually there for. All I knew is I'm here, I'm no longer on the run, I have now been caught, and here is my enemy, and here I am going to fight for my life. And I, from that point on, I simply felt no fear whatsoever. I just felt I had to get on and live every single day as it came, and not think of what was going to happen tomorrow, or where I was going to work. I soon realized that there were people who were better dressed, they looked well fed, and I couldn't understand how it was that there were some that were on the point of death, which you, of course you saw all around the camp, and others were in a pretty good shape. And I realized soon that there's got to be some way of survival. But of course, at that point, I didn't know the key to survival. But I did realize I was going to fight.
Yes, you talk in your book about the importance of what you call organizing. What did that mean in camp terms, and how critical was it for survival?
Well, I soon realized that there was just, first of all, the camp had its own language, and I was, of course, at an advantage because I could understand the language. It was part German, part Yiddish, part Polish. And I realized that you have to learn the language before you find your way around. And it had its own expressions, the camp. One of the most important expressions was to organize. And to organize means to obtain, to buy, to sell, to get food. There was just one universal word for barter, and that was organize. And if you lived by this principle, you had to organize, you learn how to get around certain situations. You had to organize the situations. You had to organize your life to try and get into a better work party. The key to survival was a work party which enabled you to survive, because there were work parties where you couldn't survive, and that became apparent very soon. And you had to get away. That's another thing you had to learn. Who were the people you had to get away from? How quickly did you have to get away from these people? Who people you should not associate with? Those were all sorts of things you had to learn. And I'm afraid if you didn't learn all these things within the first few days, you were doomed.
What were the good work parties and what were the bad work parties?
Well, the better work parties were work parties that did not leave the camp compound. Any work party that worked outside was a disaster from the start, because you were exposed to the elements, you were beaten, had to walk to work in all conditions, in the rain, in the snow in the winter, in the heat of the summer. So if you could work within the camp compound or undercover somewhere inside, well, you were almost immediately at an advantage. If you could work, say, in a kitchen, you were in a tremendous advantage because you were working close to food. If you could sort out clothes, you were at an advantage. If you could work in a hospital compound, you were at an advantage. The problem was, how did you manage to get into these work parties? They were all occupied. There were people there working already. Girls who were in the camp from the inception of the camp, from the beginning, they were at an advantage. They survived the most horrendous times, and of course they had the best occupations. And the latecomers, the newcomers, were the most despised, because they didn't know the way around, they didn't know how to get into better work places. So there were good work parties, and of course there were disaster parties. For instance, one of the good work parties, amazingly, was carrying out bodies. Because, for obvious reason, every time you carried out a body, you very often found a piece of bread, or you found some clothes that you could barter for more food. So certainly carrying out bodies was considered a privileged sort of occupation. Carrying shit was also an advantage, because it gave you access to the latrines, which you probably wouldn't have had otherwise. So all these occupations had advantages and disadvantages, but nothing was more disadvantageous than being on a work party, actually working outside the camp, digging ditches, carrying stones, carrying cement. I worked on the railway for a long time, the railway that actually, the lines that were laid right into the as far as the crematoria. I carried the heavy bags of cement. I dug ditches outside parties, and I realized pretty soon that I couldn't survive very long. I had to find some means of getting away from these parties. How do you do that? Well, you had to buy your way in, so you had to have something to give to somebody else, so that somebody else could do you a favor and perhaps help you to get you into a better work party. The key to survival was instant adjustment. I think that was the first key to survival. And instant realization, and having a sixth sense of where danger came from, and finding finding a way of being totally invisible, hiding behind the crowds, so that your face would never actually be known to anyone in charge, the people that were most feared.
You noted a difference in the way that men and women in the camp survived. Maybe you could describe it, what you meant by that.
Well, I've always believed that women fared a lot worse, particularly in Auschwitz, than men. I felt that men were at a tremendous advantage, because many of the men that came into the camp, first of all, they were not only teenagers, they were perhaps in their 20s and in their 30s. Because they had professions, because the Nazis needed them in the camp, some had skills. There were locksmiths, there were carpenters who were needed, and builders, bricklayers. There were professional people, there were doctors, there were pharmacists. All people and there were tailors, which the Germans prized very much because they needed to have the uniforms sewn. So the men were at an advantage. Now, the women brought into the camp were mostly teenage girls. Older women were not allowed into the camp. First of all, they were of childbearing age, so they may have been pregnant, and of course no pregnant woman was allowed to live. Many women came into Auschwitz with the children, and since no children were allowed to live, all women and children were taken straight to the gas chambers. The Germans tried perhaps not to part the children from the women, because they didn't want any trouble. So they allowed the women to go with the children, or shall we say the children to go with their women. And the women were in their 20s and in their 30s, and they didn't have any particular professions. They were of no use to the Germans, so they went straight to the gas chambers. Therefore, most of the women that came into the camp were teenage girls. They had no skills. Perhaps they were nurses, but nursing wasn't a considered profession, because there was no nursing as we know it. Anyone could have been a nurse in the hospital compound. You didn't need any special skills to be a nurse in Auschwitz. And so therefore, the teenage girls were mainly used for manual labor. And therefore, of course, the death toll was probably much higher. Having said that, the girls, were stronger mentally. They survived mentally far better than the men. They were not prone to depression, as I believe men were. They looked after one another. They formed little families. I was a strong believer that you couldn't survive on your own. You always had to have your friends, and you guarded and you fought for your friends the same way as you fought for your own life. You sacrificed everything for your friends, who would do the same for you. Well, I've always believed that wasn't the case in a men's camp. Men tended to survive alone, and this was a very difficult thing to do. And so I believe that because of that, women survived better than men, although they were at a tremendous disadvantage.
Can you describe the barracks that you were living in, and how that was organized?
Well, the barracks varied. If you had privileged prisoners, they had better living quarters in that sense that there were fewer of them in a block. A barrack, or the living quarter, is a block. Originally, the blocks, as we call them, were actual stables intended to house some 50 or 52 horses. The barracks in Auschwitz that I was in housed 1,000 women, and I'm talking about the average prisoners, the ordinary, unprivileged prisoners. Of course, things were completely different for, say, people who played in the camp orchestra. They shared a block with girls who were the messenger girls, and they may have only had 200 or 300 in the living quarters. They may have had blankets, and they may have had 2 or 3 blankets and straw mattresses, whereas we often had nothing at all. We had just kind of platforms where 8 people had to sleep head to toe, almost like in a tin of sardines, with no cover whatsoever and no means of taking your clothes off. So accommodation varied according to your privileged position. If you were in a privileged position, your living quarters may have been more bearable.
What about the camp hierarchy? Presumably you had to get to know how that worked pretty quickly. How did that work?
You soon realized that people who walked around the camp well-dressed, well-fed, usually with whips in the hands, were people that you had to avoid, and they were part of the hierarchy. The camp hierarchy was a very complex structure, and it was something that took some time to actually understand. And I believe unless you were actually in Auschwitz for 12 months, you couldn't fully understand it. Of course, I was in Auschwitz just under 2 years, and I learned to understand the hierarchy, but you had to understand it pretty quickly, because if you didn't, well, you soon knew who was beating you up. And so, although you couldn't remember faces, it what you did remember is what you did watch out was the way people walked the camp, the way they were dressed, and the way they treated prisoners that they that were under them, like the capos who were in charge of a group of workers. You always had to avoid the capos because they were only really carrying out the work of their superiors, and so you pretty well knew you had to avoid them, and the best thing to avoid them was to remain faceless and never really attract any attention whatsoever, unless of course you had a friend who was a capo, which was a very rare event if you were an ordinary prisoner. However, the longer you remained in the camp, the longer you were in the camp, and the quicker you could obtain decent clothes and perhaps leather shoes, the more you learned about the hierarchy, and the less you feared the hierarchy, because you realized that you, although you were not one of the hierarchy, you were already in some privilege, perhaps in some privileged position, because you managed to survive a longer period. So the longer you survived, the more respect you would have commanded from the hierarchy. And also, of course, that related to your tattoo. You realized that your tattoo gave you a certain status. So if you had a huge, huge number, you were a new prisoner. But if you had a low number, you were an old prisoner, and so you no longer feared the hierarchy as you did when you were a newcomer. So it had all to do with the behavior of the hierarchy towards the length of the time the prisoner was in the camp.
You talked earlier about the camp orchestra. Perhaps you could tell us more generally about
the bizarre use of music in the camp, particularly to accompany brutal punishments and so on.
It has a slightly surreal quality, I think.
Well, we had a camp orchestra, and this orchestra was situated at the entrance of Birkenau, and every morning when work parties left the camp to work outside, the orchestra had to play to drum them out, and of course they had to play to drum them back in. Mostly they were coming back dragging their comrades and probably on sort of makeshift stretchers, bringing back the bodies, because every body who worked even outside the camp and died outside the camp had to be brought back into the camp because of the roll calls which took place morning and night. The camp orchestra also performed during punishment sessions. There were punishment sessions for various misdemeanors. I mean, everything was punishable by death, or it was known as sport. So while prisoners performed sport, which very often entailed running, jumping, squatting, running, jumping, squatting in a succession of perhaps 2 hours, the prison orchestra would play the tune to which this particular group had to perform sport. But there were occasions where the camp commandant had ordered concerts on a Sunday, and he would allow all prisoners to actually sit outside their blocks and listen to a concert, which was a very rare event, but it did happen.
What kind of music did
they listen to? Well, I don't recall really. Most of the music was chosen by the SS themselves, what they wanted to be played. The music chosen for the prison parties going out of the camp were mostly German marches. But they did play waltzes and mostly German music that the commandant had ordered. I can't recollect the actual tunes.
Were there any...